Here on FM, our book of the week. Tim Moore is riding around Italy on a period road bike, retracing the route of the 1914 Giro d'Italia with Paolo Facchinetti's guide to the original race for company. He also tells the story of Alfonso Calzolari and his fellow cyclists as they tackle this most famous, or this most infamous, of road races. Tim is now approaching Genoa. Stephen Mangan reads episode 3 of Geronimo, riding the very terrible 1914 tour of Italy.
Having savoured it at trundling close quarters, I can recall almost every inch of my passage through the Italian countryside in photographic detail. Cities, though, passed in a panicked blur, knuckles whitened around handlebars, eyes taking in nothing beyond the murderously wayward traffic. I can tell you almost nothing of Genoa. Engulfed by flyovers and speeding metal boxes, I just went with the flow, swept helplessly along like a poo stick in a tsunami. I washed up that evening at a suburb named Nervi. Over supper, I got out Paolo's book again. His roll call of the Stage 1 Fallen read like some sporting premonition of the ghastly war that lay just months ahead. Alfonso Calzolari was left with just two teammates, and the Bianchi team lost almost half its riders. Most shocking of all was the total annihilation of the strongly favoured Artela squad. None of its six riders finished the stage, among them the first British rider ever to ride a Giro, Frederick Henry Grubb. An eccentric and rather difficult Londoner, Grubb had made his name by setting a number of long-distance solo records. Being a non-smoking teetotaler marked Grubb out as a sporting maverick, and he went the extra mile by riding in the colours of the Vegetarian Cycling Club. As the most talked-of cyclist in Britain, Grubb was on the team for the only cycling event at the 1912 Olympics. The Giro represented Grubb's first experience, not just of professional racing, but of cycling in a pack of other riders. He lasted just 11 hours on the road, undone not by the insufferable conditions, but his own arrogant aloofness. Road race cycling has always been curiously companionable. So, as a wine-averse Olympian lettuce muncher who failed to fraternise with other riders, Grubb's fate was sealed. Everyone suffered some form of equipment failure, but only Grubb's mechanicals were the result of enemy action. He returned home chuntering bitterly about the Continentals and their beastly ways. They would stick an inflator in your spokes as soon as look at you. When I woke up the next morning in Nervi, horizontal rain was gusting onto my face through the shutters and the small gaps between my formerly drying clothes. Getting rained on as I slept was at least a small step towards empathetic hardship with the 1914 Giro's storm-tossed, frost-bitten survivors. I stuffed my jersey full of bread and strode briskly to the dry goods larder, where the Hirondelle had slept chained to a crate of beer. Up from the sea to a town perched high in the coastal cliffs, down to the sea. Back up again. Thunder rumbled from behind. I dropped my head, tightened my fists round the wooden bar grips, and tried to force the pace. I came back from the dead at Sestri Levante, courtesy of sugary fluid and 1,000 stone-baked calories. I pulled out Paolo's book again, ready as ever to take solace in how much worse it was in 1914. Then, as the riders saddled up outside the Cuneo Tavern, where they'd gathered at 3:45 a.m. for breakfast for Stage 2, the landlady complained that half of them hadn't paid. When she noticed that all the hams and salamis hanging up in the rafters to cure were now conspicuous by their absence, she ran out into the street just as the starter fired his pistol, giving her a rearward view of 37 jerseys with some very funny lumps in them disappearing at speed. A cocktail of fog, rain, mud and bone-chilling cold had everyone hitting the deck. One rider after running over a dog, Calzolari after slamming knee-first into a guardrail, an incident that would add a little top note of pain to every pedal revolution from then to the finish. You know how sometimes you pitch up in a strange town and just instantly fall for it? La Spezia was not one of those. I groggily sloshed my way to the station and stumbled into a hotel that looked as tired as I felt. I had a few new Italian phrases to try out. "Bicycle in the room of me is possible?" I said to the proprietor. The room of me proved disagreeable. Mosquitoes lined up in wait all around its scabrous walls. My antique ensuite incorporated a repulsive shower-bidet combination. I climbed into it, yanked my kit off, and hit the taps. A mighty jet from the intimate spray nozzle shot water straight into my face. 12 hours later, La Spezia pitched me unfed into the breakneck obstacle course of the morning rush hour. Ever-erratic scooters buzzed me into collapsed drain covers. Lorries blasted hydrocarbons into my face at point-blank range. I was pursued through two tunnels by the bendy bus of death. Pedestrians swaggered out into the mad traffic at will. My brakes, such as they were, proved to have no respect for this force field. After the storm-lashed, carpet-tacked horrors of the opening leg, the 1914 stage from Cuneo to Lucca was a rolling downpour over 340 non-stop kilometres. It claimed 10 further riders, whittling down the field to 27. These days, Giro riders don't need much encouragement to pull out. In the 2013 race, Lord Wiggo and a number of other competitors retired citing head colds, flu-type symptoms, and similar conditions of the sort that I wrote in my mum's handwriting when I didn't fancy PE. Contrast this with the 1914 race leader, Angelo Gremo, who fainted at La Spezia due to unbearable pain in the legs and kidneys, yet still tried to climb back on his bike when he came round. "I can make it to Lucca if I pace myself," he croaked to the gathering reporters. I'd always planned to stay in Lucca, which, as the Stage 2 finish, marked my quarterway point. The shop, called Ciclidea, which I chanced upon just outside the city walls, sealed the deal. The smell of oil and new rubber seeped out through the door, and a queue of old people held variously stricken bicycles. In a state of quiet wonder, I took my place at the back. I was on the shop's threshold, second in line, when the youngest mechanic walked up. "I have a problem with my central movement," I said, which sounded like a euphemism for constipation. He appraised my undercarriage. Diagnosis was crushing and instant. "Non ne abbiamo così in Italia." "We don't have those ones in Italy." "Chiavelle?" I wheedled in a semi-whimper. The native word for cotter pins was now a conversational cornerstone. He went back inside and came back with a club hammer and a nasty smile. "Chiavelle," he said, then knelt down by the hirondelle, and as I grabbed the bars, belted it smack in the cotters. Chonk! Crank! A lusty hammer blow on the end of each pin. My hands were still vibrating when he stood up and said, actually almost spat, a single word command. "Vai!" "Go!" I pedalled away from the Ciclidea to find the padonk merely retuned to a kasnik. I was furious. How dare they treat my proud old steed like that? This was personal. That was my bike that I'd built, that I'd suffered with and slept with. The 1914 survivors rolled out of Lucca towards Florence at midnight, seen off by a huge crowd of spectators. It was a memorable start to what would be the longest day in Giro history. The stage finish lay 430.3 gravelly kilometres away in Rome, the equivalent of London to Newcastle. When I reached Florence, it seemed folly to pass through without having a peek at the cathedral, but with its mighty terracotta dome just a piazza away, I found myself mobbed by camera-toting well-wishers. Rain-resistant crowds clustered around a grandstand full of trophy-toting dignitaries. I had blundered up to the finish line of a bicycle race. A barrier was unhitched and I was shoved onto the finish line. With an uncertain smile, I looked out from the celebrity pinnacle of my life to date. A paparazzi photo call at the 2012 Women's Tour of Tuscany. Apparently, the entire field had got lost outside Florence after someone switched a few route signs. It would be some time before an angry peloton rolled over the line, and I spent most of it being patted on the back, photographed, and giggled at. With the sun out, I could see why this area earned the nickname Chiantishire. It looked like the Cotswolds left a bit too long in the oven. Everything had browned and risen. And risen. And risen. By mid-morning, I toiled up to 700 metres, the leaden weight of sweat-soaked merino wool pulling me back downhill. Here was the old Chianti, the region that in 1914 found itself cursed with some of the most desperate poverty in all of Europe. It was extraordinarily remote. Just me and the occasional walnut-faced farmer in a three-wheel pickup. The blazing sun brought a billion flies to life. Most seemed very keen to investigate the inner workings of my ear. I defended myself in a manner that would have alarmed passers-by. There weren't any, though, nor a single town or hamlet where I might have acquired cold fluids and something to eat. Only the descents kept me going, those delicious gusts of cool air blasting sweat off my messy red face. Bonus refreshment came courtesy of the carbonated water I'd filled my bidon with that morning. At downhill speeds above 40 kilometres an hour, the juddering front wheel bobble agitated the contents so violently that a fine spray forced itself through the screw top threads and all over my thighs. I crawled into Siena. Coke, salami panino, Coke, extra cacao, milk, water, and more water. It all went down in the shade of a grocer's awning. Feeling much less dead, I wove off through the alleys. The absurd heat had been building to some sort of climax all afternoon, and now hit it. The heavens abruptly blackened, and a terrific whip-crack of thunder ricocheted off the ancient walls. I pushed the Hirondelle out into the pitiless monsoon and pedalled slowly across the deserted square. Just past Siena's city walls, I ducked under a bus shelter and for the first time donned my shriekingly 21st century bright orange rain jacket. The heavy metal sky was overflowing helplessly, as if God had fallen asleep in the bath with the taps running. I pointed the Hirondelle south into the headlights and double-speed wipers of the evening rush hour. Each passing car flung a bucket of grey-brown Acqua da Strada hard at me. My feet quadrupled in weight. Every heavy revolution squelched out little dribbles of sock water through the ventilation holes in Gerard Lagrosse's shoes. Through some perverse osmosis, rain endeavoured to saturate my saddle, from where it was eagerly blotted up by my chamois groin pad. I threw in the wet towel at Buon Convento. The ancient proprietor of the old hotel put his hairless head through a beaded fly curtain and granted my request for a room with a palpable lack of enthusiasm. When I wheeled the Hirondelle inside, I could hear him bitterly regretting this decision. No, signore, no, no. With sudden vigour, he all but vaulted over the desk and bundled us out into the street. Scrabbling out a key from the huge bunch tied to his belt, he hobbled over the road and battled open a door that sounded as if it had last been closed in 1973. It was a cobweb jumble of discarded appliances and one-legged chairs. I should have felt guilty leaving my trusty steed alone with those dusty ghosts, but propped between a radiogram and a listing hat stand, he looked more at home than he ever had.
Episode 3 of Geronimo, riding the very terrible 1914 tour of Italy by Tim Moore, was read by Stephen Mangan, abridged by Libby Spurrier, and produced by Joanna Green. It's a peer production for BBC Radio 4.
Join me, Mel Gedroich, each weekday afternoon on the 4 o'clock show as we hear more of the entertaining entries that have made the shortlist for Radio 2's 500 words competition for writers aged 13 and under. And if they're anything like those that have been part of the fantastic 50 so far, we can anticipate more terrific tales by awesome young authors.
Hello, I'm Mish Iglesias, the new maid.
Puffing out my chest, I raised my head in pride.
Call this art, Jamie Owen. A three-year-old could do better.
500 Words continues on the 4 o'clock show, weekday afternoons, over on BBC Radio 4 Extra.